The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
In 1932, Herbert Sims became Dublin City's first housing architect, a post which he held until his tragic death 16 years later. But over that time, he led a small team who became the drivers in policy and output for housing in Dublin City at a time when the corporation turned out 17,000 new homes. And his legacy is still very visible to us today, but many may not even have heard of the man behind the developments in Crumlin, Cabra and beyond, as well as in the inner city. Eoin Óibrin, the Sinn Féin TD, along with Mal McCann, have documented the work and impact of the city's first housing architect in a beautiful new book. It's entitled Flats and Cottages, and Eoin is with me now. Eoin, good morning and welcome.
Thanks for having me, Pat.
Congratulations on the book. It's fabulously produced. It's a lovely book.
It is, and Mary Impress, the publishers who Mal and I did the Bosaris book with a couple of years back, have really excelled themselves. And the designer, Stuart Coughlin from Cork, has also really contributed to what I think is, what everyone thinks about the text, and we can get into that in a second, just a beautiful production, and something that I think is testament both to Sims and his contribution to the city, and also the very many people who allowed us into their homes to photograph them and interview them about
because
life living in Herbert Sims.
People are living in Sims' efforts still to this day.
That's right, and you know, these are buildings that are 90 years old plus, and they were built to the highest possible standards at the time. They really stood the test of time. And in fact, Dublin Corporation, one of the things we deal with in the book, have actually undertaken a pilot in Ballybock House to see to what extent can they fully deep retrofit them to bring them up to modern standards. And when they strip the buildings back to their bare bones, these are really good quality homes, albeit ones that need significant refurbishment to meet modern standards.
Now, we've got to think of the time that all of this happened. I mean, we have a new state, the Free State, and it's less than a decade in existence when Herbert Sims is appointed by Dublin City as the city's first housing architect. They didn't have much money.
They didn't, and the city had a huge housing crisis. Infant mortality rates, for example, in the inner city were four times the rest of the city. We had a workforce which was primarily casual, both male and female, in the docks, in the factories, and the warehouses.
And where were people living before that, before this great initiative by the corporation?
They were living in one-room tenements. I talk about my own great-grandparents, the Wheelers, and my own grandmother. They lived in a single-room tenement in St. Augustine Street, off Thomas Street. There were almost 80 people in that building, single outdoor toilet. And again, the rates of mortality, of cholera, of tuberculosis, just the poor quality living conditions were appalling. And of course, what's significant about this period of the 30s and 40s is under pressure from good quality councillors, from campaigners, government eventually decided to fund the local authorities to clear the tenements and to build what would have been at the time state-of-the-art, in fact, as described by some of the people I interviewed, luxurious homes, flats and cottages to provide working people with decent accommodation in their own city.
And I've been going through the book and reading some of the excerpts about what might be described as luxurious. It depended what you came from because, I mean, there might be no indoor toilet, for example, in a brand new house.
Yeah, and it's interesting, people's perception. So Eileen Delamere, who was 96 when we interviewed and photographed her in 2022, she subsequently passed away. She remembered vividly the first day she moved into her own flat. It had hot water, it had cold water, it had a toilet, it had her own bedroom, and she talked about it as luxury.
But probably didn't have a bath.
It didn't. In fact, she describes fondly the copper bath with a wooden top that fitted underneath the kitchen sink, which they also used as a dinner table. Right? In East Cabra, for example, Shane Mallon talked about his grandfather and father's home that he grew up in, and the toilet was outside. So, of course, bath night on Saturday was a pretty terrifying affair because you'd pull out the copper bath in the kitchen, you'd be in the kitchen having your bath, and if one of your siblings needed to get to the toilet, they had to come through that kitchen. But at the same time, given that these people were coming from single-room tenements, these were coming from some of the worst slums in Europe, these were state-of-the-art modern homes. And, of course, over time, some of them were improved. Cabra now, of course, almost invariably has indoor toilets. But there is also a history of poor maintenance, of neglect, of not responding to the needs of local communities, and as well as the very positive stories that the tenants and residents and now homeowners in some cases talk about. They also talk about those negative experiences too. Some of these flats in Oliver Bond, for example, is today among the worst rental accommodation in the city. It's damp, it's mouldy, it's poor quality conditions. And though Dublin City Council is doing everything it can to try and fix the flats, they're not getting the funding from government to do so. So there are very real issues in these communities today that have to be addressed.
Now, they might have had, you know, a couple of bedrooms, maybe even three bedrooms, but that doesn't mean they're big. They managed, by dint of design, to cram a lot of accommodation into a very small footprint.
They did, and for example, when I reflect on my own grandparents' experience, they eventually moved from Oliver Bond out to Drimna, what was known as North Crumlin at the time. They actually found those homes, which are relatively modest size, too big, and actually moved back into the flats for a period of time before they resettled out in Drimna. But yeah, these were, by today's standards, small homes. People didn't get their own.
By the way, these
private
small homes are selling for almost $500,000 in places.
Yeah,
like,
and if you look at the homes in Carbert and Crumlin, for example, built with poured concrete, they're going to last hundreds of years. People had generous back gardens to grow their own vegetables. Mm-hmm. People had public spaces that they wouldn't have had in the inner city tenements. And even in the inner city flat complexes, which were based in design on similar flat complexes in England and in the Netherlands and in Vienna, they had courtyards, but didn't necessarily have the generous public amenities that those other European countries would have had at the time. But at the same time, they were clean, they were dry, they were safe, they were healthy, and they have provided homes for tens of thousands of Dubliners over 90 years and will continue into the future. And there's something very important in that lesson, that when the state decides to utilise its resources, albeit very meagre resources in the 1930s and 40s, to give working people good quality homes, it's remarkable what the state can do when it puts its mind to it.
But we come to the man himself, Herbert Wheeler, and I mean, he was the driving force behind a lot of this quality. I mean, there were other voices, and I found it strange to hear there were some people advocating timber houses.
Absolutely. So Sims is a really interesting character, and we still don't know enough about him. Eddie Conroy, the former county architect in South Dublin, is the kind of leading authority. He did his master's thesis in Sims in 1999, which kind of sparked the revival of interest in him. Sims was a working class Londoner. He'd fought in the Second World War. He was injured and rewarded for bravery.
In the First World War?
In the First World War, apologies. He got a scholarship to study architecture and planning in Liverpool. That's where he met Abercrombie, the famous planner who had been brought to Dublin some years earlier to design a redevelopment plan which was never implemented. And that sparked his interest in coming to Dublin. He got a job with the corporation. And then after a short period of time in India, he took up this position as the first Dublin housing architect. But actually, not a lot is known about him. We know what he did. We know the work and the very prodigious output that he was involved in. But Sims the man is still relatively unknown. Eddie Conroy, when I interviewed him for the book, was saying that because, of course, Sims eventually took his own life at the end, in part for issues of post-traumatic stress, depression, and the huge pressure of work that he had. A lot of people were embarrassed to talk about him many years later when Eddie was doing his research. So do we know a lot about Herbert himself? No, we don't. But what we do know is this man, along with his team and all of the others who played a part, transformed the lives of generations of Dubliners. He left a physical imprint which has enhanced our streets. Anybody who walks past...
Okay, now people will buy the book and see some pictures of those buildings which are still standing. But for those who casually visit the capital and who won't have seen your book, how can you recognise a Sims building?
Yeah, so they're typically four-storey stair access flat blocks that have what we call landing or deck access, so those long balconies.
So everyone has their own front door.
Everybody has their own front door, but they also have a kind of a street. So there's you know, an opportunity to engage. Ellen Rowley, one of our wonderful architectural historians, talks about how the balconies were perfectly suited for women to sit and lean and observe and police the courtyards where their children would have been playing.
And only four stories, so therefore, if they need to get down quickly.
Exactly. Chancery House, for example, is probably one of the most beautiful, just beside the forecourts there, beside Ormond Square, but also Emmett Buildings, for example, down in Watling Street. Some of those smaller schemes, they really are quite beautiful. But if you look at the detailing, for example, on Markievicz House on Townsend Street, again, really beautiful kind of modernist Art Deco features, really enhance our streetscape, really add something to the urban fabric of Dublin as a city. But also even the suburban schemes. When we were doing the book, one of the copy editors from Marion Press, Wendy, was like, what's remarkable about the houses? They just look like regular houses. Mm. Well, they didn't at the time. They were this new, a streamlined design of suburban housing. And again, they have beautiful little features and little details, notwithstanding the fact that they were built at a time when materials and labour was in short supply. So they've really added something to our city, both in terms of the quality of the accommodation for people at the time, but also the built fabric and the kind of the urban fabric of our city and our suburbs.
Now, some of the problems were the high cost of labour. And you think, okay, you wouldn't expect in Ireland there would be expensive labour. But there was, because there was a shortage.
That's right. So all of the problems that we talk about today, so for example, material supply shortages, labour shortages, inflation, industrial unrest. In fact, one of the reasons Dublin Corporation started in-house direct labour was because some of the private companies they were using to build Crumlin had industrial action, went on strike, so the council just employed the trades folks directly. But also that issue about timber and modular homes, issues about should we keep existing buildings, in that case Georgian buildings, and refurbish them, or should we knock and build new ones? All of the debates we're having today, we had back then. And what Sims, I think, brought to those debates was, one, a political will to try and drive large volumes of production. But the other was quality of standards, quality of materials, but also a quality of community. Some of the people we interviewed talked about how when they were moved from the tenements, the families that had been above, below and beside them in the tenements were above, below, beside them in the flat blocks.
And that was a deliberate policy to keep communities
together. Retaining that sense of community. Absolutely, hugely important for Sims and his team at the time. And in fact, when they were doing Ballybock House in the north inner city, they were originally talking about displacing some of the tenement dwellers to, you know, even further into the suburbs of Dublin at the time. And the women marched on Dublin Corporation at the time to say, no, we want to be kept where we are, where we're from. Gemma Dunleavy, the wonderful Dublin rap artist, I interview her at the end of the book. She spent the first year of her life living with her mother in her granny's flat in Sheriff Street. And she talks about that really strong sense of community, which, of course, in Sheriff Street and Teresa's Gardens and in Fatima, was displaced because of demolition and then flinging families to the four corners of the city.
But of course, and we know famously about the experiment in Ballymun later on, where people were displaced and there was, okay, you might say you can play in the fields, but there was precious little else to do.
Yeah, and what's wonderful, I suppose, about Sims wanted, and Dublin Corporation at the time wanted, to build more inner city flats than suburban cottages. But there was a kind of reformist zeal among civil society. The Catholic Church got involved. They didn't like communal living. They didn't like the association of crime, of prostitution, of communism.
They wanted the garden
with
city.
The tenements. They wanted the fresh, clean air of the garden city. But actually, the communities themselves, they wanted to remain where they were. Yes, they wanted better standards. Yes, they wanted better amenities. But these are people who, for multiple generations, had been inner city families. And again, when I interview the residents in various places, the women's group in St. Mickens, for example, at the back of the Bridewell, at the end, I ask them, like, would you live anywhere else? And sometimes people look at me like I have two heads, like, why would you live anywhere else? Yes, fix the problems in our flats, but this is where we're from. We're very proud of our communities.
But they are literally a 10-minute walk from the Spire.
Well, St. Mickens is the very definition of inner city. And in fact, again, that was one of the really wonderful interviews. Seven women who, you know, some of the women were in their 70s, some in their 30s. These are women who had left school at the age of 12, 15. They've worked their entire lives out of the home and in the home. They've imbued their own children with this very strong work ethic. But they're proud of who they are. They're proud of who they're from. All they ask is they be treated with a little bit more respect and dignity, and that the conditions that they're living in are brought up to modern standards. They work hard, they pay their rent, they look after their flat complexes really, really well. In fact, in the case of St. Mickens, at the women's group there, they run after schools clubs and school projects and summer projects for the kids. And again, that's a neighbourhood that doesn't have a wild lot of amenities. Yes, Phoenix Park is up the road.
But you have to look at social policies over the years, where you have some of the more modern blocks that have had to be destroyed. I mean, they just haven't stood the test of time. And part of the reason, when I look at various flat complexes around Dublin City, where the corporation decides these are finished, these are bunched. So we put all our social problems into those. I'm thinking of O'Devney Gardens. I remember when that was built first. It was pristine. It was wonderful. It was a great, great housing experiment. But eventually it became where you put all the problems. And now it's being redeveloped yet again.
So the interesting thing is, if you look at the history of public housing in Ireland, the overwhelming majority of public housing estates have been successes. They're really good places to live. I think what went wrong in the early 90s was, instead of public housing being for a large range of working people, people with no jobs, with some jobs, with poorly paid jobs, with well-paid jobs, from the 90s on, public housing became housing only for very vulnerable people, only for people with complex needs. And we lost a little bit of the income mix that makes communities very viable. When I was interviewing the family in East Cabra, and I was asking them, what was it like when you were growing up? The guard lived down the street, the shopkeeper, the tailor, the bricklayer, the unemployed families. People lived together in working class communities. And I think if we want to learn the lessons from then, it's about public housing shouldn't just be housing for the very, very poor.
Yeah. I mean,
it should be housing for all categories of working people in mixed income communities.
On this program, we've covered stories about, say, Kensington in that borough, where people of all incomes are paying rent to the local borough. When they retire, then their income falls, their rent falls too. It's a nice model.
There is a myth out there among some people, and far too many people in the world I live in, that public housing has, in the main, has failed. If you look at all the evidence, Tony Fahey, and I quote his research in the book, one of the leading scholars of public housing in the state over the Celtic Tiger era, the overwhelming majority of social housing estates were and continue to be really good places to live. Again, all of the people I interviewed in the nine estates for this book and that Mal took portraits of, when we asked them, do they like where they live? Is this a good place to live? Invariably, they all say yes. There are challenges. Oliver Bond, for example, doesn't just have problems with damp and mould. It also has a very entrenched drug problem. That's an issue that has to be addressed by the state in terms of investment in communities and in policing. Likewise, for example, in St. Mickens and elsewhere, people want their estates fixed. They want to remain in those places. That's a testament of success. And again, I could take in my own constituency and any number of public housing estates. People would chew your two arms off to get into those estates to rent or buy. So we need to celebrate the successes. We need to learn the mistakes. But crucially, we need to adopt the same political will for large-scale housing for working people today that motivated Sims and his generation in the 30s and 40s. Otherwise, we'll never address the housing need that's out there in our society.
Was it a mistake over the years to sell off the housing real estate built by the corporation to the tenants, by and large, who seized the opportunity to buy at a bargain price? So good on them. They did well out of it. But in policy terms, was it a mistake?
I don't think it was. I think it's a mistake to allow those houses then to be sold into the private market afterwards. But Shane Mallon, for example, in Cabra, who I interviewed for the book, five generations of his family, including his daughter and grandson, have lived in that home, in part facilitated by tenant purchase. So tenant purchase keeps working class people in those communities as they advance economically. I think the crucial thing is, if somebody opts not to pass the property on to their children but wants to sell, they should have to sell back to the council at the original discounted price, index-linked for inflation, to stop those becoming private properties. But tenant purchase does give intergenerational security of tenure, and as in Shane Mallon's family in Cabra is a case in point, that's a really good thing for community cohesion.
Well, it's a very handsome hardback. It's called Flats and Cottages, Herbert Sims and the Housing of Dublin's Working Class, 1932 to 1948. And it's co-authored by Mal McCann, who took all the great pictures.
And the launch is tonight at 6 o'clock in City Hall, and people are welcome just to drop in and join us.
And the man who did all the joined-up writing, Ona Brin, thank you very much for
very much, Pat,
joining us in the studio. Now, coming...
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
On News Talk.